What is polyglot programming?
Well, so one of the people I've talked to about this quite recently is Ted Neward, and I kind of agree with him that polyglot programming is one thing, but language-oriented programming is a little bit better word for it. Basically, what you said about is that we realize more and more that one major language is not good enough. It's better to have lots of small languages that are good at specific things. Now, the first part of this movement is DSLs, domain-specific languages. And obviously, I mean, they are the first example, but they also make it very obvious that we should use the right language for the right task. So polyglot programming has to many degrees now started questioning if the major languages we're doing right now, like for example Java, is actually a good language to use for all circumstances and in all layers of a programming environment.
So why are you questioning that? Why isn't Java the one true language? Or on the .NET platform, why isn't C# the one true language?
Well, first of all, Java misses so many things that you need to... I mean, in my mind, you can roughly divide things into three different layers. And the topmost layers is the layer where you have the DSLs, the domain-specific implementations. And basically, this is the part where you're trying to shape your application in such a way that domain experts, not necessarily programmers, can actually help you out by validating this logic. Now, Java is not a good language to implement DSLs in, because it's just too verbose, it's too inflexible, it's got static typing that makes things cumbersome. And to actually make an external DSL, you have to use a parser generator, you have to write all the logic for this in Java. And it works too in Java, of course, but it's usually much more painful than you would be able to do with something more malleable. Now, the DSL layer is obviously the most important part, but it's also important to take a look at the second layer, the layer where most of your application logic should reside. The DSL layer, I see that as where the actual customization, the rules for a rules engine or something like that lives. But then you have the application layer, and this layer needs to be quite a lot of code. You need to have code that you can change easily, code that doesn't really set, and in many circumstances, this part of the application is more about gluing together different libraries. So in these circumstances, static languages have a tendency to get in the way. Now, Java is not really a good static language either. It's got loopholes, and you have generics, and everything kind of gets a big mess. Lots of people have written much better about that than me. So basically, Java fits when you need the performance of having a static language where you have established tools that you can work with correctly and so on. And I don't think that Java actually is needed at all soon. We don't have a good replacement right now, but I think that a new replacement should be on the way. A static language that works on the JVM that kind of is the systems-level programming languages on the JVM. I hope that Scala is going to be that, but I'm not sure. I haven't decided yet.
Mm-hmm. So what's the advantage of Scala over Java for that system layer, the performance layer?
Well, exactly. First of all, you have the performance. Now, Scala have access to the same types of Java, but uses type inference to make quite a lot of code more compressed. It's got full language support for closures, for first-order functions, and so on, which makes it much easier to express certain algorithms. All of this while still retaining the same performance and having static typing. In many regards, Scala's static typing is much stronger than Java's, trying to emulate the static typing of the ML language family or Haskell. And this makes it just easier to get good performance, but while still having flexibility of an interesting type system. Now, Scala static type system is actually powerful enough to handle lots of interesting stuff that you usually only can do in dynamic languages. So it seems like it's the best of both worlds.
Can you give me an example of a DSL layer that's kind of used in the real world out there in the wild?
Well, the typical example of an internal DSL is if you've seen Rails Active Record specification, where you say how two different model classes relate to each other. You can say that a blog post has many authors, stuff like that. Now, that is a typical example of one internal DSL, where the DSL in itself is not really a separate language, but just a carefully thought out API. Mm-hmm. That is one example. Many rules engines, like Drools and so on, have an external DSL where you have a small language where you actually specify how rules should be handled. SQL should probably be mentioned as one of the most common domain-specific languages. So there are different kinds of them.
So to go back to the Rails example, I never thought of Active Record as a DSL. I know some people have talked about it. Some people have also talked about the way that the controllers handle the views and the views themselves as DSLs.
I wouldn't go that far.
Sure. But in that case, in the case of Rails, if you were going to consider Active Record to be a DSL and you're going to consider the other aspects of creating a Rails app to be DSLs, you actually have many DSLs on top of your application.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that is, that's a pretty common occurrence because an application usually have one core domain, which is the business domain, but you can have many technical domains that your application works in. And I'm kind of expecting that we will see several DSLs in every application because that's just the way we build stuff right now. A rules engine to handle some parts, a business DSL to actually handle the core business logic, or maybe even several business domain languages that you kind of create separately and can bring together into one application. It's a little bit fuzzy. I mean, in many of these cases, it's gonna be hard to draw a hard, fast line. What part of it is the language and regular libraries, and what is a DSL?
Yeah, I can see some confusion there.
Yeah.
So I work in a large enterprise, and we have a really difficult time trying to get new languages to come on. What are some of the hurdles that you think to this approach, this polyglot programming? How do you get widespread adoption of this approach?
Well, I mean, in many cases, widespread adoption isn't really the issue. If you realize that it's a good thing to do this, and I think that more and more programmers will understand this, you will just naturally evolve towards that. Now, just because we're talking domain-specific languages doesn't really mean that we have to transform your organization to use a new language. That is one of the good parts about running on top of the JVM, and why I'm so happy that more and more languages are getting traction on top of JVM, because in many of the large enterprises and organizations, I'm seeing that the fact that it's just a jar file and some script code that runs is actually a very good argument to get the IS people to accept it, even though they wouldn't accept it. For example, take Ruby. Most IS organizations wouldn't take a regular Ruby application and manage that, but we have seen that happen in several enterprises by using JRuby. Actually, one of my colleagues just said, okay, so this is just a Java library, and this is a rather long configuration file. I don't necessarily condone that kind of deception, of course, but it's sometimes useful.
So what you're saying is that the fact that you're on the JVM, the fact that you're on already accepted platforms within an enterprise, that should help grease the wheels.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
The pragmatic programmers, Dave Thomas, Andy Hunt, they're active in the Ruby community, and one of the things that they talked about in the Pragmatic Programmer book is to learn a language a year. Is the idea of polyglot programming just an extension of learning a new language each year, or is it something else?
It's a little bit of both. I mean, of course, the reason you should learn a new language a year is because I tend to believe that the Sapir-Whorf theory is actually correct, that the languages you can think in actually shapes the way you can think. So if you haven't subjected yourself to a specific programming idea, you can't really think in ways that are based on that. And what that means is that if you learn a new programming language that has some interesting new concepts that you haven't ever found before, that will make you a better programmer no matter what language you're using. I mean, I used to program in Lisp, and that kind of experience have definitely made my Java code different. I use different concepts, and I write code, well, seriously differently from how I used to do before that. Mm-hmm. And so that's part of it. That's the reason why every programmer should learn new programming languages. But I also tend to believe that nowadays handling DSLs is different from learning a new language here. I think you would be able to need to be able to learn languages more often than that to handle a DSL world and language-oriented programming world. Because in many ways, DSLs and programming languages is going to continue to be proliferated. I hope and think that we're going to see much more small languages. And if you're good at picking up languages, this is something that will make it easier for you to handle this.
Mm-hmm. So you see a major shift then. You see, whereas today we're really, we've got a handful of languages that are used broadly and in the vast majority of all applications being written. And then we've got a couple handfuls of other languages that are seeing much smaller use. You're saying that in the future you see a much greater variety of languages being used across all applications.
Yeah, basically. Mm-hmm. I do think that we will have a few languages that will be the core and the kernel of most places. Like Java is probably never going to get rid of, and it's probably going to be there a little bit forever. And C-sharp and those languages, but I think that the proportion of their usage will get lower and other languages will take more space in the typical application. And we were already seeing this. I mean, domain-specific small languages and having more than one language in a project is not really new. If you look at the way basically every application around uses Java, uses Ant. I mean, the XML file is actually its own language. You have SQL, you have HTML, you have JavaScript, you have CSS. You have all these different languages embedded in one application. And I do believe that this is more or less an extension of that.
Mm-hmm. So where do you see the system languages like Java being used in the future? Are they just for the boilerplate code to bring up an application, or are they used in just the libraries that are going to be used by all of the application and DSL layers? Or, you know, where is that going to be used?
Well, so the libraries, we will never get rid of the libraries. Now, the libraries are one of the good parts about being on the Java platform. Of course, we will be able to implement libraries in other languages too. So Java is not really needed for that, not necessarily. The boilerplate code, I really hope that we don't have to write the boilerplate code in Java, because that is exactly the problem with Java, that so much of it is boilerplate. So what I feel the best part for Java is kind of like the way we do it with C right now on an operating system. We fall back for it. We fall back on it when we need it. I see the Java platform as an operating system, and Java is the operating system language, like C is to Unix. You fall back on it when you need it, but most of the time you're spending your time in writing scripts, for bash scripts, or writing applications on top of this. And you only fall back to C when you need it, for performance or for other reasons. There might be some capabilities that you can only access using your Java, just as most of the other languages have their own thing that you can't do from Java.
You work for ThoughtWorks, and you guys work on lots of really interesting projects. And you also work with a lot of IS organizations. How do you see IS organizations managing the additional complexity brought on by maintaining or using so many new languages? And does the benefit of using the right language for the right task, does that get erased by the overhead due to managing the additional complexity of those languages?
I would say that the additional complexity is not something that, I mean, this is ideally, the IS organization shouldn't care, shouldn't see that. They should take care of the application that runs on top of the JVM, but they shouldn't really care or need to know if it's Ruby or Java or whatever. As long as the infrastructure, as long as the language in itself is good enough so it can be handled like other Java libraries. Well, the infrastructure should already be there, and it shouldn't matter. So I'm trying to eat my cake and have it too, by hoping that we can fix those problems. I mean, obviously that's not the way it is right now for all situations, but I think that we can fix that so that the IS just needs to know that it's on the Java platform. They need to take care about the application server, etc., but they don't need to actually touch the application.
So why not just use Ruby?
For everything?
Yeah, well, why would you want to separate out the system layer from the application layer to the DSL layer? Why not just move to a language like Ruby, which is pretty malleable and, you know, for most purposes is pretty easy to manage?
Mm. True enough, but there are things about Ruby that are problematic. I mean, for a typical example, the infrastructure and the ecosystem isn't really there yet. I mean, just look at all the libraries you have in the Java world, for example. Now, this is why I really do believe that JRuby is the way to go, because you have the combination of the language Ruby with the platform of Java, and this is actually quite important, the possibility to fall back on Java. Of course, in Ruby you can fall back on C, but falling back on C compared to falling back on Java is really two different worlds. So I hope and believe that JRuby is going to be the way forward for this kind of programming, and that you won't need to fall back on Java so many times or so much. But if you actually want it or need it, well, it's going to be there.
What do you say to the programmers who really don't want to learn new languages?
Well, this is where it's time to get a little bit harsh. I mean, if you aren't prepared to learn new programming language, I think it's going to be really hard to call yourself a programmer. I mean, some people can always make their living by continuing. I mean, obviously, there are people who still only program in COBOL, and you can make your living that way, but most programmers will probably need to be more focused on languages. Now, in some cases, this might mean that we will get fewer programmers, but hopefully we will get programmers of better quality, more proficient programmers, because this is one of the problems in the Java world, for example. There are so many very mediocre programmers, and there are so many programmers who actually add negative value to a project.
Like I was saying before, yourself and Neil Ford have talked about this openly on your blogs. And I think to some people, this idea of this polyglot programming world seems like just an idea, whereas you guys, when you talk about it, it seems like an eventuality. You know, what evidence is out there that you can point us to that reinforces your stance that we're moving to a polyglot world?
Well, the people I know of who are looking at this, I mean, Ted Newage, Jay Fields, Martin Fowler is also looking at it quite a lot. I mean, he's writing a book on DSLs. Stuart Holloway is looking at it. Many people in the Ruby world are trying to use Ruby for internal DSLs and trying to shape the libraries in that way. So there are a few people. For some reason, most of us are within .orgs, but there are absolutely people doing this outside. Also, you have people you have companies like Intentional, who is working on a system for DSLs, allowing you to have a workbench where you can develop your DSLs and get support from the IDE to edit these DSLs, where you can emit the code for handling the DSLs in different languages. Now, Intentional has been doing this for a long time. JetBrains, I think it is, have their system called MPS, which they are working on to more or less do the same thing. So there are companies who are putting money behind DSLs, that's for sure.
So how is JRuby coming along?
JRuby is coming along very good. Right now we are quite close to doing the 1.1 release, and that release is going to improve performance substantially. It's going to fix incredible amounts of bugs, and basically we're just trying to work on compatibility. Rails and most other stuff works really well and have for a long time, so right now we are trying to just improve the situation even more, trying to include some more advanced compiler techniques and so on. So I would say that it's coming along, and the ecosystem around it, they're starting to come up libraries for doing certain things and so on. So it's actually really interesting. It's fun stuff.
Excellent. So what are you guys doing in JRuby to help facilitate the polyglot programming world? You know, how are you making it easy to use JRuby from your Java applications?
Well, right now, I mean, so for a long time you have been able to use JRuby through BSF or through the JavaScripting framework, and these are the major ways you should be using it. Now, both of those frameworks are incredibly simple to work with, so and you don't really need much more than that to be able to work with it. We are in the process of planning on trying to, I'm not sure at what time frame this will happen, but we are looking at how to get JRuby to emit Java class files that actually correspond one-to-one with Ruby class files. This is going to be a little bit hard for several reasons, because Ruby class files are so much more malleable and so much more flexible than Java classes. But this is something that will come along, and this will make it even easier to use Ruby classes from Java. Also, the JRuby team is involved in JSR 292, which is the JSR to add support for dynamic languages to the JVM. I'm part of that expert group, and this is one of the things that will absolutely make it easy for DSLs and small languages on the JVM, because, well, you need that kind of support from the JVM to make it really performant.
So can you talk a little bit about that? What exactly are you looking at changing on the JVM to facilitate dynamic languages?
So the core of the idea is something called Invoke Dynamic, which is it's a new bytecode that mimics all the other invoke bytecodes on Java, but the specific purpose is that with Invoke Dynamic, you can invoke on type. No, sorry, on name, not in type. Regularly, when the JVM loads up bytecodes, it verifies that all, say, for example, if you have invoke interface, then invoke interface, that bytecode will be verified that the method that you want to call on that interface actually exists. This verification process is really good, but it makes it extremely impossible to do dynamic invocation directly. Now, Invoke Dynamic will have no verification of that sort. It will just be able to call on anything that has a method with a specific name. The counterpart of that one is also that you will need to be able to add and remove methods to classes dynamically at runtime. So that's also something that we're looking at. Then we have a few other things that are interesting for the ecosystem that we think we need in some way. For example, we are talking about lightweight method references. We are talking about tuples. We're talking about tail call optimizations and even continuations. But of all these, the lightweight method handles are the most important part. So we're looking at several different things that will be able to improve the situation for many languages. We don't want to add something just for one specific language. We want to add something that actually is going to be highly usable for all the dynamic language implementation out there.
Have you seen many applications, again, living in the real world, that use Java as a system layer, or using JRuby as the application layer, and with JRuby hosting some DSLs on top of that?
Well, no, I haven't yet. I think it's coming, but I haven't seen any large real applications. We are kind of steering our ideas towards it, but right now we're still in the startup process. We do have a few applications where we built, say, for example, Ruby on Rails applications that are deployed with JRuby and so on. In that case, and also using a few Java libraries and so on. So that would qualify if you look at ActiveRecord as including a DSL, because then you have the Java system layer, you have JRuby as Ruby, and you have the DSLs. Mm-hmm.
So what complications do you see arising from using that type of architecture? We've talked some about the benefits, about the developer productivity, the simplification of the domain, but what are some of the challenges for using this approach?
Well, obviously the first step is the problem with IDEs, and the problem with IDEs and actually getting good tool support is always harder than it is with regular static languages. That is one problem. That's not, I don't think it's a large problem. The second problem is getting the borders between the languages working correctly. Right now, the libraries aren't really there yet for doing that. So that's one of the things that I'm looking at, how you can do it better. For example, I quite recently released a project called JTester, which makes the integration of JRuby into a regular Java project kind of non-existence. So you can use Ruby testing frameworks to test your Java code. Now, this kind of stuff that weaves Java and Ruby systems together is something that we will need for a while, so that the borders between the different layers is going to be as easy to handle as possible. But except for that, it's just a matter of time, I think. And I think it's going to be a quite organic process where people start using this approach more and more, especially when we start talking about the domains where you actually need it, which are especially large domains where the complexity of the coding is going to basically be overwhelming if you don't take radically new ideas and ways of getting stuff done.
So I found it interesting that you were talking about the IDE as being one of the challenges. Myself, I tend to wonder if having such a full-featured and complex IDE is also a symptom of the problem.
Absolutely. I happen personally to be a person who only uses Emacs for programming, but the IDE question is something that that's something that other people who use IDEs share. So I'm reporting a potential problem or a potential perception of the problem that IDEs is going to be a part of it. But tooling in general is always something that we need to a degree.
The world that that you're describing, this polyglot programming future, does seem to be in a lot of ways much different than the world we're living today, but in a lot of ways it's very similar. If you're going to give some advice to some new programmers just starting out, what would that advice be on how to prepare themselves for this future world?
Yeah, I think it's quite simple. Get used to learning new languages. Understand languages and understand the good features of different kinds of languages and learn to apply them effectively. That's basically it. Learning languages is a skill. After you learn a few languages, it's very easy to pick up new ones. So you have to learn the skill of learning languages. But you also have to, if you really want to start thinking about these things for real, you need to start thinking about how to design languages that are good for a specific domain. And that basically takes practice.